From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Why did our federal government fail to disclose its own studies of the health hazards at Ground Zero? We need answers.
A leading environmental group raises new questions about the Bush administration's handling of the cleanup of downtown Manhattan in the days after 9/11. We'll speak with the author of the report and a downtown Manhattan resident who suffered respiratory illnesses from World Trade Center dust. Then the FBI is paying visits to activists around the country to question them about their involvement in protests at the Republican convention. We'll speak with some of those questioned and examine the implications for civil liberties.
What concerns us is the FBI questioning is part of a pattern of blurring the line between mass protest and terrorism.
And former death squad leader Luis Jodel Chamblain is acquitted of a murder charge in a midnight trial in Haiti. He was convicted in absentia 8 years ago. We'll speak with the international lawyer Brian Concannon about the case and the new U.S.-backed Haitian government. All that and more coming up. Good day. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. In Najaf, U.S. tanks have surrounded the holy Imam Ali shrine where Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is believed to be holed up. Yesterday, associates of Sadr suggested he was ready to vacate the shrine and disarm his militia after 10 days of fighting. Al Jazeera is reporting that Sadr has also demanded the U.S. withdraw from the holy city. Instead, the U.S. has moved closer to surrounding one of the holiest Shiites in the Muslim world, the holy shrine. CNN is reporting that the U.S. and Iraqi forces may use military action within the next day if Sadr does not personally and publicly announce he is disarming. Iraq's defense minister said, quote, "The coming hours will be decisive and we will teach them a lesson they will never forget." Meanwhile, in Baghdad, U.S. forces stormed into Sadr's city and reportedly killed 50 Iraqis. In other Iraq news, a national conference meeting to pick a 100-member interim legislature has ended in a storm of controversy. The legislature is comprised almost entirely of former members of the U.S.-appointed Interim Governing Council and pre-selected members from five major political parties. Many candidates who attempted to run were removed from voting lists for technical reasons. A slate of independent candidates removed themselves from the selection process in protest. Many other delegates simply left the conference. No actual vote was taken. The slate of 81 candidates was simply approved at the end of the conference. The 19 former members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council were given automatic seats. Abbas Kadim, an Iraqi lecturer in California, compared the selection of the legislature to elections under Saddam Hussein. He said, quote, "There was no election whatsoever. It was one list of names prepared by the government. Take it or leave it. Not much different from Saddam's elections when he always won by 99.9%. The head of a group called Free Iraqi Civilians and Officers said, quote, "It's impossible to build Iraq in this way. Representatives of Prime Minister Iyad Alawi and other officials want a parliament that just roots for them and not for the Iraqi people." A leading Republican congressman from Nebraska, Doug Baruta, has broken with party ranks and admitted that he now believes the U.S. was wrong to invade Iraq. In a letter to constituents, he wrote, quote, "It was a mistake to launch that military action, especially without a broad and engaged international coalition." Baruta, who served as vice chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, is retiring from Congress this month after serving 26 years. In New York, United for Peace and Justice filed a lawsuit yesterday against the city of New York for not allowing the group to hold a massive anti-war rally in Central Park on August 29th, the day before the start of the Republican National Convention. In Venezuela, the opposition to President Hugo Chavez has announced it will not take part in an audit of Sunday's vote, where voters overwhelmingly backed the Chavez presidency. The Organization of American States and the Carter Center have deemed the vote free and fair, but the opposition maintains that there was massive fraud. A federal judge yesterday held reporters from four major news organizations in contempt of court for refusing to name confidential sources in their records on Wen-Ho Lee, the nuclear scientist once accused of being a spy. The judge ordered reporters from the New York Times, LA Times, Associated Press, and CNN to tell Lee's attorneys the names of federal officials who provided them confidential information. And the AFL-CIO was estimating some 6 million workers could lose overtime pay when new federal labor rules go into effect on Monday. The new rules allow employers to exempt from overtime pay most workers making a salary above $23,660 a year. The Bush administration circumvented Congress and changed the rules through the federal regulatory process, even though the Senate voted twice since April to block the changes. House Republican leaders blocked moves to overturn the new rules. And that's some of the headlines. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who's in Berkeley, California today. As Republicans prepare to descend on New York City for their party convention in less than 2 weeks, a leading environmental group is raising new questions about the Bush administration's handling of the cleanup of downtown Manhattan in the days after 9/11. A new report by the Sierra Club charges that the Bush administration was guilty of reckless disregard by failing to inform Ground Zero workers, area residents, and rescuers of health risks from toxic air after the collapse of the World Trade Center. The report, titled Air Pollution and Deception at Ground Zero, blames the thousands of cases of long-term respiratory illness among New Yorkers on the White House and the Environmental Protection Agency, saying they downplayed health risks, shirked their regulatory oversight roles, and even urged financial district workers to return to their jobs prematurely. The EPA reacted to the report by saying, quote, it was a blatant attempt to use this tragedy for political gain. In addition to misleading the public about the health hazards of the smoke and dust at Ground Zero, the report finds that the Bush administration's mistakes are now in danger of becoming policy for handling future disasters. With us today to talk about that are the author of the report, Susan Matei, an attorney who heads the National Field Office of the Sierra Club in New York. She's the author of Air Pollution and Deception at Ground Zero. We're also joined by Joe Paulette, a downtown Manhattan resident who lives near Ground Zero. She has been diagnosed with reactive airways disease and GERDs from World Trade Center dust in her apartment. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Suzanne, there have been quite a few reports in recent years about the federal government's handling of the environmental problems at Ground Zero. Could you summarize what are some of the new findings that your report has put together? It's a 184-page report. It's quite comprehensive. It took me about a day to read it. Luckily, I was able to get an advanced copy. Tell us about some of the some of the findings.
Sure. Well, when I first started this report, I thought I would find some political spinning of a few early press releases followed by some bureaucratic bungling. And I thought it would take me maybe 4 months to write this thing. Instead, it took over a year because I found a lot more than that. I found that EPA did not find hazards because they did not look for them. And when they did find hazards, they either didn't tell us or they came up with very lame excuses for why we shouldn't be concerned. And it was layer upon layer of deception and disregard. I found out that EPA had surveyed their own employees, their office employees, who work at 290 Broadway, which is maybe 7 blocks away from the towers, found out that they were sick in December, 3 months after the attack. Long after EPA had told everybody, come back to Lower Manhattan, told families, come back, bring your kids, everybody was told to return. They find out their own employees are sick. But I had never heard of that study. Nobody else I knew, nobody else that I talked to had ever heard of that study. I went through EPA's press releases. Nothing, no word about this study, but it was published in a scientific journal. EPA knew about it.
It was published in July of 2002,
July 2002, very quietly. But the public did not know about it. I found other strange things, too. On the website, for example, there's a class of chemicals called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So we'll call them PAHs. But this is a very toxic group of chemicals. Some of them are hormone disruptors. Some of them are cancer-causing. Some of them may cause genetic defects that can be passed on to offspring. There's been some new research around that, a lot of concern around that. They said on their website that they found no PAHs in the air, which I couldn't understand because it's hard to burn anything without finding them. So
So PAHs are basically a product of uncontrolled burning.
Of uncontrolled combustion, mm-hmm. Yes. Mixed materials especially. And so I was going through a bunch of footnotes to another scientific article, and I saw one that I'd never seen before. So I hunted it down, and yes, somebody had done some early testing, and yes, they had found PAHs at significant levels, comparable to a severe ozone smog episode in Los Angeles. And lo and behold, the researchers were from Research Triangle Park, EPA's own research center. So they had taken samples. They had even published a study about it. But on their website, they were telling the public they didn't find it at all.
And once again, that study was published, I think, in August of 2003,
like
about 2 years later.
Yes, yes. But they had the samples, and they had done the tests. They didn't test for PAHs in the dust at all, as far as I can see, as far as I can tell. But we found private tests that were done of dust from firefighters' boots, and many, many times higher than the standard that EPA would use for removing PAHs from soil at a Superfund site. So there were a lot of hazards. There were a lot of things like this that I found, and that other people have found in snippets. You put that together with the fact that OSHA decided, for heaven only knows what reason, that they were not going to do any enforcement of health and safety standards at Ground Zero. And the whole thing is completely baffling. It's hard to understand why the federal government behaved the way they did, but the consequences are not hard to understand.
Well, let's get into that.
Yes.
Joe Paulette, you are a downtown Manhattan resident. You became very sick after 9/11. Could you talk about your experiences and how you now reacting to this report of the Sierra Club?
Yes, sure. After September 11th, I spent a week with friends in another part of the city. The government said the air was safe. I came home. And I was fine for a few weeks. And then I started getting symptoms that I ignored at first because they said there was no problem. So I came down with bronchitis and, you know, called the doctor, but wasn't concerned. And then I had symptoms like inhaling. I would have soreness when I inhaled. But, I mean, I went to the website. They said expect short-term symptoms. And they said that scientific data doesn't show there'll be any long-term health problems for area residents and workers. I mean, it should have occurred to me then that how could they talk about scientific data on long-term health consequences when it was 3 or 4 weeks after the event? But I trusted the government. Eventually, I lost my voice completely, and then I had started having trouble breathing. That was in November. I was lucky because I went to a physician, a specialist in environmental medicine, and I got proper treatment, and I was told that I had to leave the area until my building was professionally cleaned.
And how long did you then stay out of the area?
Was, let's see, my EPA got around to my building. When was it? It was July of 2003. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the other people that you've been in contact with in the various citizen groups in Ground Zero, how extensive, and maybe, and Suzanne, you can talk also in terms of what you found in terms of how extensive has been the impact, not just on the Ground Zero workers, which people are more perhaps aware of, but of the residents in general.
Okay. Well, Suzanne should talk about the studies because she really knows them. But what I see... And one of the things that happened early on, I mean, there were people who became sensitized to the dust, like me. And people like that, I mean, every time you get exposed, you become more sensitized. People who didn't get out in time or didn't get the appropriate medications, a lot of those people now have new onset asthma, which at this point will not go away. And then there were people, I mean, at a certain point, I was asking my doctor, well, there are people living there that are fine, so what is this about? And, I mean, her comment was, you know, maybe the people like you are lucky, because by then she knew that there was lead in the dust, there was PAH, that it was very caustic, there was glass. And so, I mean, I guess the concern is, what are we going to see later? I'm running across people. A lot of the people who became sensitized left. People who could afford to leave and who were sick moved elsewhere. But I guess every month or so, my organization, 9/11 Environmental Action, gets an email from somebody who has symptoms and doesn't know what to do. And it's just the people who didn't get the early treatment are people who are never going to get back to where they were in terms of breathing capacity. And it's just unnecessary.
Suzanne, your study mentions a particular red flag, which was a health center in Chinatown that had an enormous increase in the number of childhood asthma cases among Chinese-American youth. Could you talk a little bit about that? And,
sure.
And again, when was that finally publicized?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't have it right in my mind of when that was publicized, but it was fairly recently. And what they did was they looked at a group of children who were visiting an asthma clinic. They had data on these children from the year before the attack and the year after the attack, and they found a very significant increase in their visits to the asthma clinic, in the amount of medication that they had to use. And not only that, they found a tremendous increase in patients, like I think it was a 67% increase in patients. They had another asthma clinic out in Queens, and that clinic actually saw a decrease in the number of patients and did not see any of the kinds of increases that these children in Chinatown experienced. And that's of concern, first of all, because this is a very sensitive population, because asthma can be life-threatening, but also because many of those children were not even living in the zone that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency designated as its cleanup zone. You know, they sort of drew a line on the map and they said, we'll clean some of these apartments on request, but no place else. And some of these children lived outside that zone. So that's of concern. I'm also concerned about the transit workers. Many people have no idea, but there were about 3,000 transit workers who responded immediately to the disaster. They were the hard hats, the welders that came down and cut the steel so that the rescue workers could get in and try to find people. Most of them did not have proper protection, and many of them are sick. I'm concerned about the cleanup workers. There were hundreds of low-income people, most of them immigrants, who were hired off the street to clean the buildings, clean the sidewalks. Very few of them had any protection. And there was a study done by Stephen Markowitz at Queens College, the Center for Biology of Natural Systems, and they found that nearly all of them were sick. So you know, this is all of great concern.
And we're only talking right now about those who suffered immediate effects. We're not talking about the long-term problems that, like cancer or others that may have a longer latency period before we'll see the effects.
Yes, and the immune system effects will be impossible to measure. How do you know what causes what? If you have a weakened immune system, you just get sick more often from a whole lot of things. Nobody's going to be able to track that at all. And
so I'd like to ask you, your report has shown some of the more obviously deliberate attempts to withhold information from the public, but it also centers in on the role at the top. Specifically, I think, and I've looked at all of the reports and investigations on 911, and interestingly enough, yours is the only one that that really points to information that was already out there, but no one had connected.
Yes.
which are the two books by former anti-terrorism czar Richard Clark and by former Treasury Secretary O'Neill about what President Bush said and did in the days immediately on 911 and in the following days about what he wanted done in New York City. Could you talk about
that?
That's
right. He wanted the stock market open immediately. He wanted it open the very next day. He obviously had no idea of what had really happened in New York City. And I believe it was Paul O'Neill who explained to him that the computers were underwater, so they weren't going to be able to open the stock exchange the next day. But there was clearly tremendous pressure at the top to make that happen. And one can understand the desire to get things as close to back to normal as quickly as you can. But civilians are not soldiers. They're not supposed to be put in harm's way. And whatever you do in whatever kind of war you're fighting, you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to put civilians at risk. And that's really what happened here. They had plenty of experts who knew that this stuff was harmful. It's not as though the experts at EPA looked at that big dust cloud and said, gee, I wonder what could possibly be in there. You know, they had a pretty good idea of what was in that cloud. And they should have issued a warning immediately. And the pollution should have been considered guilty until proven innocent, not the other way around.
So, and obviously with President Bush ordering that he wanted the stock market in downtown opened immediately, the question was, what did Christy Whitman, as the head of the environmental agency of the EPA, say to him about public health risks? And what did he say back? And that's the one part of this puzzle we still haven't found out.
That's right. I didn't find anything in my Freedom of Information documents that I requested from the EPA on that. No, nobody really knows for sure. We don't know beyond the White House Council on Environmental Quality, how much further up did it go? These are the unanswered questions, and we have to get those answers. We have to understand what happened here, because we have to assume that a national disaster will occur again. It may not be from a terrorist attack. It may be from an accident. But we have to know how these decisions are made and who is being put at risk and why. And we have to figure out a way to make sure that this never, ever happens again.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us. Suzanne Matei, an attorney who heads the National Field Office of the Sierra Club in New York, the author of the new report, Air Pollution and Deception at Ground Zero, and Joe Paulette, a downtown Manhattan resident who has been suffering the health effects of the Ground Zero contamination. And we'll continue to cover this story, and I have a column on it on your report in today's New York Daily News. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
soldiers were dead and gone. If only we could bring back one, he'd say we gotta have.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has visited political activists in at least six states to question them about their involvement in protests at the Democratic and Republican national conventions. FBI officials describe the questioning as part of a larger effort to track any planned disruptions related to the conventions, the presidential debates, or even the November elections. An FBI spokesman told the New York Times this week that individuals visited in recent weeks are, quote, people that we identified that could reasonably be expected to have knowledge of such plans and plots if they existed. But civil rights groups say the 40 to 50 documented cases of FBI questioning amount to harassment and result in the chilling of free speech. Several Democratic legislators this week issued a letter to the Justice Department's Inspector General calling for an investigation into the FBI questioning and calling it, quote, a systematic political harassment and intimidation of legitimate anti-war protesters. Today, we'll hear several stories from individuals who have faced intimidation and interrogation from the FBI and other law enforcement agencies. We're joined first by Sarah Bardwell. She's an activist and intern with the American Friends Service Committee Denver chapter and questioned by the FBI and Denver police at her home. And she joins us by phone from Denver. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, Sarah, could you tell us a little bit about your experience with the FBI?
It was Thursday, on July 22nd, there were four FBI agents and two Denver police officers who came to our house in the afternoon and told us that came into our house, and we asked them to stay on the front porch, and they told us that they were doing preemptive investigations into suspected terrorists about actions planned at the RNC and the DNC. And then they proceeded to ask us if we were planning any criminal activity or if we knew anybody who was planning any criminal activity for the convention.
And what did you tell them?
Myself and several of my roommates told them that we were choosing not to answer those questions.
Did they persist, or did they tell you you had to answer any questions?
For the time being, they didn't persist, actually, about the questions. They spent a lot of time sort of looking into our house, taking note on the things that were on the walls in the living room, asking us about what our house was and who we all were, and they asked us what our names were, which we also told them that we wouldn't give. Finally, though, they did say that since we weren't giving them the information that they wanted, they were taking that as non-cooperation, and they were going to have to therefore take more intrusive efforts in the future to find out what they needed to know. But they wouldn't specify what they needed to know specifically or what those more intrusive efforts were.
Well, we're joined on the phone also by Mark Silverstein, legal director of the ACLU of Colorado. Your reaction to these visits, and were there any others in the Denver area?
Well, there have been a number of other such visits or similar visits in Colorado that we're aware of, and of course, there's always the possibility that there have been additional ones that we're not aware of. I'm very, very skeptical that these visits are what the FBI claims them to be. They don't sound like a good faith investigation of reasonably suspected criminal activity. They sound much more like visits designed to intimidate these young people from engaging in protest activity or from associating with people who are engaging in such activities. And the questions the FBI asked are not the kind of questions that would be asked if they're really trying to investigate suspected criminal activity.
Have you gotten in the reports that you've gotten of other people in the Denver area? What have been the actions or the statements of the FBI agents?
The questions are similar, and in several of them, the FBI people have clipboards with papers that include pictures, photographs of the young people. And I think one of the things that communicates is we have files on you, and you're in those files. And the larger message that it communicates is that if you participate in actions critical of the government or government policies, you might wind up with an FBI file. And the danger, of course, is that these kinds of actions on the part of the FBI could deter people from joining a protest, from signing a petition, from writing a letter to the editor, if they feel that that's going to prompt FBI scrutiny and maybe an FBI file. And it's unwarranted for peaceful, nonviolent activity that's 100% protected by the First Amendment. You shouldn't risk having a government police file because you criticize the government.
Well, we're also joined on the telephone from Cleveland by Esther Sassaman, a Palestinian rights activist who was told she was on a terrorist watch list and intimidated at her job in that city. Esther, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me on.
Could you tell us about your experience with the FBI?
Well, I actually didn't have an experience with the FBI. I had a much more informal experience with the Department of Homeland Security. The first Wednesday in July, I was called on the carpet at work. My supervisor was there, and so was the head of security at my job, and he said that he'd gotten an informal notification from, quote, a buddy of his that works at the Department of Homeland Security, and they said that they had been monitoring my internet activity and that they thought that I was a terrorist. That was the first thing that happened. My boss told me to delete everything from my computer at work before that to show them representative examples of the communications I had made. And they said if they had gotten one more comment like this, then I'd be losing my job. Since then, I have not gotten any kind of formal contact from the Department of Homeland Security. This was an entirely informal contact. I believe it was meant to intimidate me, and there has been no written record of it or physical show up by these agents whatsoever.
Well, I'd like to ask Mark Silverstein of the ACLU in Colorado. This, even though it's an informal contact, sounds like it's even an even bigger problem, because it's one thing to visit somebody at home. It's another to make contact with someone's employer and to put their job in jeopardy.
Well, I don't want to... this is the first I've heard of this, and I don't have the specifics, so I'm not going to be able to answer questions about that specific episode. I'm sorry.
Well, just in general of people being contacted, employers being contacted by federal agencies about suspicions or allegations about individual employees. You don't feel you can comment on that?
No, I'm sorry. I know about what's going on here in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, maybe I can say something. After it happened, I did contact the local ACLU office, and the director of that office notified me that this is a common tactic that they'll use. The Department of Homeland Security or the FBI or whatever will make a cold call even to the head of security at a workplace or some kind of responsible official and just make these statements. I do know that the individual supposedly called the head of security up at my job about a week later to see if I was terminated, which I was not. I think that they were just trying to cause a hard time for me, and there's just no paper trail of it. So you're right, it is hard to keep track of these. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who aren't even reporting that this is happening to them, and they're just sort of sitting in fear.
I guess one of the missing things, I think, I don't know what the content of these internet communications were, but I mean, it sounds like you're saying that these, depending on what the content of them were, that could inform whether the FBI action is wholly unjustified or whether there's some basis for it. I'm assuming that these were just commentaries that are just criticisms about particular issues.
Yeah, and a lot of them weren't even that. What happened was I went to Palestine for 2 weeks in September of 2003, and I came back and I had made lots of contacts with people there, especially young people, students. A lot of folks have internet communication there, and you can chat with them in real time or send emails back and forth. And basically, I was just, you know, sending emails back and forth during my lunch hour. Most of them weren't even political in nature. They were about personal matters like people's studies at school and so on. I think that they just don't like you to reach out and talk to Palestinians. I think that that itself might be part of the problem that they had.
And how did the FBI find out what... That you were engaged in these communications?
I have no way of knowing that. I can only conjecture that it was through the internet monitoring systems that we all know and love so well, like Echelon and Carnivore, you know.
Well, we're also joined here in the studio by Eric Larson, a member of the A31 Coalition, which has called for direct action protests on August 31st during the Republican National Convention. Welcome to Democracy Now, Eric.
Thanks.
Could you tell us what's been the impact of these kinds of visits by either Homeland Security or FBI agents to people on their jobs and in their homes, and what's been the impact on your organizing efforts?
Well, to begin with, there's a sort of a chilling effect that happens, especially for people out of town who are planning to come here for the protests. There's going to be maybe hundreds of thousands of people coming to New York and mobilizing in New York to protest the convention and the Republicans. And this sort of activity really sends a message that if you have a certain political point of view, that you could be subject to harassment. And when I say chilling effect, that means maybe people will decide not to come here. Maybe people will decide to leave town. Maybe people will decide to stay in rather than coming out into the streets and protest. And that's very disturbing. We haven't seen a lot of effect on our organizing because we're really looking for people to come out and do direct action civil disobedience. And it's hard to intimidate people who are willing to do something like that to begin with. That's the fortunate part. The less fortunate part is that people who might want to take to the streets and exercise their rights in a more direct way for the first time will be thinking twice about it, and that bothers us.
There's also a report here that from WABC News here in New York that New York police are now shadowing 56 protesters believed to be the most dangerous that are coming to the protest at the Republican National Convention. I'd like to ask Mark Silverstein again from the ACLU in Colorado. This whole question, obviously, the government is saying, "Well, we're in a different time now. We're in a time where of high terrorist alert, especially with the Republican National Convention." But where does government properly draw the line between being able to secure the safety of citizens while at the same time protecting the rights of those who dissent to be able to protest?
Well, I can tell you that one place a line was drawn here in Denver was in the resolution of our class action lawsuit challenging what became known as the Denver Police Department spy files. We challenged a program of the Denver Police Department's intelligence unit that's probably similar to things that other law enforcement agencies have been doing around the country, where they monitored people's exercise of First Amendment rights. They built files, and in some cases they had defamatory and erroneous labels for certain political groups, such as, quote, criminal extremist, unquote. And the line that was drawn in the resolution of that controversy here in Denver is that the police are forbidden to monitor or keep files or collect information about how people exercise their First Amendment rights unless there's two conditions met. First, the First Amendment activity, such as, you know, people's viewpoints or what groups they belong to, or, you know, what demonstrations they've gone to, police can't collect that information or store it in criminal intelligence files unless that information about people's views is directly relevant to criminal activity. And second, there has to be reasonable suspicion that those particular individuals are directly involved in that criminal activity. And a further line drawing here in Denver is that even though peaceful nonviolent civil disobedience, even though there's a venerable tradition of using that as a tactic to express viewpoints or to oppose government policies, it's illegal. It's a crime. That's why people get arrested, or they even cooperate in their arrest often when they participate in that civil disobedience. But in Denver, we drew another line, and that is that even though such peaceful civil disobedience is a crime, and even though it people's participation might be directly relevant to their participation in that crime, the Denver Police Department's intelligence unit isn't going to build files based on that activity, based on any criminal activity that amounts at most to a misdemeanor.
Well, here in New York City, the police department is not only building files. They've announced, according to this WABC report, that the department will be is especially concerned about anarchist groups who disrupted the WTO conference in Seattle and who've threatened to do the same here. And the NYPD says that they've identified 56 members of anarchist groups who they will be they have already assigned teams of police who are flying out this weekend to Boston, Washington, North Carolina, and California to begin 24-hour surveillance of these 56 people. Each one of the 56 has been assigned six policemen and one supervisor. So that's multiply that number of New York City cops who will be leaving this weekend to surveil 24 hours a day, 56 members of who they consider members of anarchist groups coming to New York. So that gives you an indication of the scope of the surveillance operations going on to head off possible disruptions of the Republican National Convention. That does it for this segment. I want to thank our guest, Eric Larson, who has joined us, and as well from the A31 Coalition, as well as the other guests who have joined us, Mark Silverstein of the ACLU in Colorado, Sarah Bardwell, an activist and intern with the American Friends Service Committee, and Esther Sassaman, a Palestinian activist, Palestinian rights activist in Cleveland. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Former Death Squad leader Louis Jodel Chamblain, who twice helped coups against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was acquitted of murder Tuesday in a secretive trial that went into the middle of the night. Chamblain was second in command of the paramilitary group FRAP, the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti. In 1991, the group overthrew Jean-Bertrand Aristide's government and went on to kill thousands of Aristide's supporters. After years in exile, he returned to Haiti earlier this year to play a key role in the February coup against President Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected leader. In 1995, Chamblain and former police chief Jackson Joannis were convicted in absentia of assassinating pro-democracy activist Antoine Ismery, who was a former justice minister under Aristide. But this week, the convictions were overturned during the secretive proceedings. Chamblain praised the outcome, telling the Associated Press that, quote, it was a true trial, just and equitable. But Amnesty International criticized the actions of the new U.S.-backed Haitian government and said, quote, this is a very sad day in the history of Haiti. The U.S. State Department also publicly criticized the proceedings. A spokesman said, quote, we deeply regret the haste with which their cases were brought to retrial, resulting in procedural deficiencies that call into question the integrity of the process. Both Chamblain and Joannis remain in prison to face other charges. We're joined by Brian Concannon, who works for the International Lawyers Office in Haiti, where he spent the last several years prosecuting crimes committed during the 1991-94 coup. Welcome to Democracy Now, Brian.
Thank you, Juan. It's great to be here. If I may correct, I'm right now director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which is a successor to the BAI because of the Haiti's coup, we're not able to do the same type of work, so we created a new organization.
Well, your reaction to this this shotgun trial that occurred of Chamblain?
It was a no-show trial. What they did, there was plenty of evidence. They did not produce it. There were plenty of witnesses. They did not call those witnesses in. Some of the witnesses they did call were dead. Several others were out of the country or didn't really know anything. The investigating judge didn't do what he was supposed to do under the law. The prosecutor did not prosecute. It was clear that the intent from the beginning was that there be no risk of conviction. And in fact, the justice minister hedged his bets by saying even if there was a conviction, he might pardon Chamblain. But he also said that when Chamblain turned himself in back in April, the justice minister said he had nothing to hide, which was a clear sign to the prosecutor, which the prosecutor obviously got.
And now the trial started, there were conflicting reports, some that was in the middle of the night then, that it started late in the afternoon and went through late into mid-morning or into the early hours of the morning. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, they started doing some of the procedural things like picking the jury in the afternoon, and it stretched and they kept going until I think it was a little bit before dawn when it finally ended, which was a serious handicap to people who wanted to monitor the trial. It was also a handicap because they announced it. Usually these things are announced weeks or months in advance. They announced it unofficially a few days in advance, and so human rights groups and journalists did not have the ability to really mobilize and organize to monitor this trial. And then as it stretched into the night, a lot of people had to leave because, as you know, Haiti streets are very dangerous places with political persecution and kidnapping and murders. And a lot of people said, "Yeah, I'd like to monitor this trial to see how safe it is, but I'm not going to put my life on the line for it."
Well, it's unheard of here in the United States for any trial, especially a murder trial, to go on through the middle of the night to reach a verdict in one day. But that's...
in Haiti, there's actually some tradition of that, but it's a tradition that we had broken during the democratic government. They when there was a serious trial, they did in fact take a break and make sure that everybody was fresh, because obviously a jury, even if he's trying to do a good job, by 4 in the morning when you've been listening to testimony or watching procedures for 12 or 18 hours, you're obviously not going to have the same powers of concentration.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much, Brian Concannon, for being with us and updating us on the Chamblain trial. We end today's program with part two of Democracy Now!'s national broadcast exclusive conversation with Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu. Vanunu was released from prison in Israel earlier this year after serving 18 years for revealing to the world that Israel had a nuclear arsenal. For more than 11 of those 18 years, he was kept in solitary confinement. Since his release, an international campaign has been launched calling on the Israeli government to lift restrictions placed on Vanunu, which, among other things, forbid him from leaving the country and forbid him from speaking to foreigners. Despite these restrictions, he agreed to talk to us around midnight Israel time on Tuesday night, risking prison again. Mordechai Vanunu spoke with us for an hour, discussing his work as a nuclear technician at Dimona, his decision to blow the whistle on Israel's secret nuclear program, his capture, and his 18 years in prison. Today we hear the conclusion of Amy Goodman's conversation with Mordechai Vanunu.
You went into prison before the first intifada of the Palestinians. You come out now 18 years later. What has changed?
What happened?
What has changed? What is the Israel you see today?
Oh, a big change since 1985-86. In 1985, there was a very strong peace activist movement in Israel. There was less nationalism, less Jewish right-wing people, Jewish religion parties. We have now a very hard, difficult reality in Israel. A lot of flags running everywhere, and a lot of parties, Jewish religion parties, very right-wing. We had a lot of death that happened in 18 years, and many suicide bombers that gave much more justification for all Israel policy. So the situation became bad. We forget what Israel did to the Palestinians in 1948. We forget what Israel did in 1967. And now we are remembering only the Intifada and the suicide killers. We forget what Israel did for many, many years before. That is the big difference, and the situation is very bad. That was my feeling.
And your attitude to the suicide bombers?
I am anti-suicide bombers. I am anti-violence. I think the Palestinians caused damage to themselves by choosing this answer to Israel aggressive. They should know very well that Israel wants using these suicide bombers to serve Israel policy, to do what they want, to build the wall, to take more land. The Palestinians should have known very well that Israel want them to do this act to justify Israel aggressive and Israel non-real peace. That was also the system against me when I was in prison. They used to make me aggressive and to fight them back. That would justify to put me in hard life. That I learned a lot in prison about the Israel spy mind, psychological warfare by very sophisticated super spy psychologists who are fighting the Palestinians and the Arabs. They should learn a lot about this psychological warfare and not to fall in traps. So the Palestinians caused damage to themselves, but that is not giving justification for Israel, and Israel must solve and give the right to the Palestinians, the citizens, the children, all those who are under occupation have the right to be a human being and to feel free. Cannot hide themselves behind suicide killers.
Were you tortured in prison, Mordechai Vanunu?
No, they never use physical torture, but I suffered a lot cruel psychological torture, psychological warfare, brainwash. They used a lot of modern psychological brainwash and psychological torture, and they use very modern warfare like to cause health problem, to try to damage my health by very sophisticated system of nutrition. They know what combination of nutrition can cause heart problem or the heart attack. So I was following all what they are doing. They use psychological torture by disturbing my sleeping every night they want. They used to make me angry any time they want. They used to make me upset. They used to disturb my TV. Anything they lend me new about my life every day. They use that information anytime they want against me to make me angry, upset. Part of making me angry and upset is to send me to eat a lot of garbage food that could damage my health. All this I was following and learning and give them good answers. And I survived, I think, and I hope can live many more years.
Did any of your Israeli jailers ever express sympathy to you for what you had done, revealing Israel's nuclear secrets?
No, almost no one. Some of them, they said, yes, we believe you did it for conscience, but no one said, yes, we are against nuclear weapons. That is the problem with the Israel people. All of them, they have no courage or open mind to say that the Jewish people have no right to use atomic Holocaust weapons. That's what I'm saying. Those Jewish people who suffer from the Holocaust have no right to use atomic bomb, because atomic bomb are going to be used only against cities, against civilians. That means atomic bomb is Holocaust weapons. And that is the problem now for all the Israel. You will not find one Jewish man in the Knesset, one from any party, from the left to the right, who will say, we have no right to have nuclear weapons. That will not exist by killing civilians. So I didn't meet anyone who sympathized with it. Only now a few people, very small group of the left, are expressing such views. But most of these Jewish people, they are following blindly their leader, Sharon, or anyone from even Peres, the man who received Nobel Peace Prize, is not yet going to speak very clear that he don't want nuclear weapons or he want to abolish nuclear weapons.
Your comments about the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon.
Israeli Prime Minister Sharon, you should remember, was the man who bombarded Iraq reactor in 1981. He was defense minister of Begin government. In 1981, when I was working in Dimona, Sharon gave order to destroy Iraq reactor. So that means when Israel destroyed Iraq reactor, it means Israel wants to free all the Middle East from nuclear weapons. Not only Israel will have nuclear weapons. So we demand now from this Sharon, that he now in the government, prime minister, to follow that example and to do the same with Dimona reactor, to open it and to declare that Israel should be free from nuclear weapons. But instead of dealing with this important subject, Israel, Shabak, Mossad give him another problem to deal with. They give him the second intifada, and Sharon fall in a trap and was fighting the Palestinians very aggressively, killing, destroying, assassinating, taking more land, building the wall, and forget that the real problem is Dimona reactor, that he was behind the policy to free the Middle East from nuclear weapons. So maybe now someone can remind him from the United States and can help him and guide him to this policy to abolish nuclear weapons. Mohammed al-Baradei was here, but he only promised him that Israel will follow this policy. But in fact, Israel is not doing anything in this subject. So I hope some foreign state government from the United States to Europe, to China, Japan, India, Egypt will remind Sharon and the Israel government to open the Dimona reactor and to make all the Middle East free from nuclear weapons, including Israel.
The full transcript of Amy Goodman's interview with a nuclear whistleblower from Israel, Mordechai Vanunu, is on our website at www.democracynow.org. That does it for today's show. For a copy of today's program, call 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Quddus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Nell Geiser, and John Hamilton. Uri Galet is our director. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer. I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.